Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am talking about a book entitled 10 Great Wine Families, A Tour Through Europe, written by Fiona Morrison, Master of Wine. This is a really interesting book, and there's some statistics that I want to lead off with. So keeping a family business together is not easy. Harvard Business School, a reputable academic institution, estimates that 70% of family businesses are sold or taken over before the second generation, and only 12% survive the third, which makes the large number of multi-generation family businesses within the wine industry even more remarkable. And this book touches on 10 very famous, very well-known wine families all throughout Europe. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, STUDYHALL, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. This book is written, let me start off talking a little bit about the author. So her name is Fiona Morrison. She is a master of wine, and master of wine is one of the highest wine credentials in the world. It's very different from the master sommelier credential. And as someone who is, you know, contemplating that path and also has taken sort of the prerequisites through the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, one of the big differences is that it requires a lot of writing. So it's not surprising to see a master of wine who is an author. A lot of them are. Some of the best wine books out there have been written by masters of wine. And it's interesting, and it's not a secret. It's definitely included in this. But one of the families profiled in this book is actually a family that Fiona Morrison married into. So there's 10 different families, and the book is arranged by seasons, summer, autumn, winter, and spring. And over the course of those different seasons, Fiona and her trusty sidekick, his name is Alexandre James. I don't know if that's a first and a last name or if Alexandre James is a double name like Mary Beth. But anyway, he's always referred to in this book, but we never see his face. They travel throughout Europe to visit these 10 different family producers. So in summer, they start visiting Familia Torres. You probably have heard the name or the label Miguel Torres in Peneda, Spain. And then they zip down to Tuscany in Italy and profile the Marchese di Frescobaldi family. And then they zip over to the Wachau in Austria and spend some time with Weingut Emmerich Knoll. And then in autumn, they spend time with her family, Famille Tiampon, in Bordeaux. So she is married to Jacques Tiampon. And I'll talk about this family, but it's lots of cousins. It's a big family in Bordeaux. They own some pretty famous estates. And then goes back to Spain to talk to, well, I'll talk about this guy in depth, but I've referred to him for years as my Spanish boyfriend, Alvaro Palacios, for Descendientes de J. Palacios. He has estates in Rioja, Bierzo, and Priorat, and then down to Portugal to talk to Dirk Nieport for Nieport Ports and Wines. Over the winter, they go and talk to the Gaia family in Barbaresco and Piemonte in Italy, and then Egon Mueller in the Schwarzhofburg in the Mosel region of Germany. And then finally in spring, they visit Burgundy and talk to the Ligier-Belair family, Louis-Michel Ligier-Belair specifically, and then Famille Perrin in the Rhone Valley. So some heavy hitters, right? These are some big time families in the world of wine. And it is just Europe. This book has a fairly specific focus. These producers vary in size and scope. I think if I were to make some broad generalizations, I would say that yes, these are some of the most famous family-owned wineries. Every family's probably best or most famous wine is crazy expensive. They do, not all of them, but some of them do make more affordable wines, but there is a certain level of rare air to some of these families, which I think is just something to be aware of for sure. And it's really important. And I read an interview that she did about, you know, why even write this book? I mean, I guess part of it is she can tell her family story, but there are a lot of reasons why family-owned wineries, particularly in Europe, are a little bit different. And she touches on rising prices in vineyards, the very specific European inheritance laws, starting, you know, with Napoleon's, the changes that he made, you know, basically banning primogeniture and where all inheritance would be divided equally amongst heirs, regardless of gender. And then she talks a lot about climate change and how that stresses wine producers and how these different producers are adapting and changing to it. So her inspiration was the fact that she's married into a very well-known family in Bordeaux. And she realized, and she says this in this interview, that some of the like the tensions and the, you know, the inner family workings, it's a complicated dynamic. I will say that I wish there was a little more tea spilled in this book. It is a very elegant and high take on these families. Sometimes when there are famous rifts and fights, they might be alluded to, but there's no hot goss here. She's not divulging any of the, like, any family scandals or anything like that. I did say that this book has a fairly narrow scope, and I was trying to figure out who this book was for. And, you know, she's writing it for people who are interested in, you know, wine and families, but this is my favorite part because this resonated very deeply with me. She says she wanted to write a book that people could read in bed, as that's where she does most of her reading. And what's really funny is that's where I did most of the reading of this book. I oftentimes read before bed. I find it allows me to sleep more deeply and restfully. And I read almost all 295 pages of this book in my bed. This book is pretty new. It was published in 2019. And so it does deal with some current events, specifically climate change, but it does deal with a lot of kind of current things that producers are dealing with, like vagaries of vintages and things of that nature. The way each chapter is organized, before I get into specific families, there's a consistent pattern to how each family chapter is addressed. So each family has sort of a description. Like for Familia Torres, it's regeneration in Catalonia. But she sort of touches on their family history, however many generations, the origins of the family, changes in ownership, maybe passed down from one generation to the next, and who did that passing down, if it was, you know, parent to child, or if there were uncles and cousins involved. She talks about maybe what they're known for. For example, with Miguel Torres, one of his passions is working with not just ancestral varieties, so old or maybe underappreciated old varieties, but then also, in his case, innovation and using his resources to tackle things like how do you deal with climate change in the vineyard. And then there's beautiful pictures all throughout. The photography is quite gorgeous. And there's usually a full, like, not portrait, but a full face photo of the main person in the family who's, you know, the head of the family or who's making the wine. So you really do get to put a face with a name, which I appreciate because I've definitely had wines from all these producers, but I've not been to or met all of the patriarchs, the matriarchs, or the winemakers. And then at the end of each chapter is Fiona's favorites. And so she lists typically five favorite wines from that one particular producer. And I mean, look, she's a master of wine. She's quite knowledgeable. And she spent time with all of these families several days, oftentimes staying with them, interviewing them. Clearly, Alexander James was photographing them and their vineyards. And so, yeah, she definitely tasted some of their wines. And she's gonna talk about her faves, as she should. So the beginning of the book starts out with Miguel Torres. And one of the things I always think about, I worked for Jose Andres for years, and I've taken trips to Spain many times. I've not visited Torres in Spain, but one of the things he's known for is being the guy, the innovator. This family winery was the first sort of to introduce stainless steel fermentation tanks to Spain, because historically what was used was, you know, oak vats, or, you know, the neutral alternative to that was like a lined concrete fermentation vessel. But innovation and modernity, we associate those things with winemaking and other things, specifically with Catalonia, with northeastern Spain. And that's where Barcelona is. And so you see like crazy, wild, creative architecture and really creative and innovative food and restaurants. And that's where you also see some real interesting wine innovations as well. She details all of that there is in the beginning of the book. And what led me to feeling a little bit disappointed that there wasn't more, you know, of the family strife talked about is it's alluded to Miguel Torres and, you know, sort of a falling out he had with his sister Marimar Torres, who you may be familiar if you're more of a domestic wine aficionado. She came to California and has made wines in California under her own label, but she sort of did that to, apparently, according to this book, maybe get away from her brother just a little bit. But not a lot of details are included. So we start off there. And then the next chapter is, after we go from Penedès, the next chapter we go to is Frescobaldi. And it's a very different style of family. The Frescobaldis have been in Tuscany for, I believe, the better part of 800 years. And they actually have some royal lineage in the family. She does describe, and I don't know if it's, I don't know where it comes from. There is some royal lineage in several of these families, but she does usually provide a physical description, and it's always very like genteel and elegant and describes, you know, the aquiline nose or the, you know, the pensive eyes or I don't know. But she's a very good writer. She's very descriptive. Her vocabulary is impressive. But it's very flattering portraits of all of these producers. And after the Frescobaldi family, one of my favorites was when she goes to Austria to visit the Knoll family. So PSA, you know, I love a pronunciation. And you're probably familiar with this producer if you enjoy Austrian wine. The last name is spelled K-N-O-L-L. And many people will pronounce it Knoll, but you actually pronounce the hard K. It's Knoll. And it's one of those things, right? If no one ever tells you, how would you ever know? If you've never been to Austria, if you don't speak German, and sometimes even if you do, you just might not know how someone's name is pronounced. And so I love putting that out there because I have bungled my way through a million pronunciations as well. So she visits Weingut, or the winery, Emmert Knoll. And they are located in the Wachau region of Austria. And I've only been to Austria once. And it was in 2017, maybe? 2017, I think. And we visited lots of different producers. And while we did not visit the winery at Knoll, Emmert Knoll Jr. actually kind of led a tasting for us. I actually think the tasting was at Domaine Wachau, but he was there resplendent in his, you know, kind of very traditional Austrian garb. And so I was kind of realigning my memories of that trip and the wines that we tasted and my memory very fleetingly of him. And one thing that kind of jogged it all back together is when Fiona discusses the types of wine that they make. So at Knoll, and in the Wachau generally, this is white wine territory. And what you really see mostly is Riesling and Grüner Veltliner. And they produce both of those at Knoll. And you may, if you don't know what these bottles look like, they're very distinctive. And they are not just distinctive looking, but they're very different looking from most Austrian bottles. On the cover, the front label is actually a picture of St. Urban, who is the patron saint of wine growers. You know, this patron saint is referenced in Germany and Austria. I mean, they're neighbors, right? But it's this very kind of dramatic painting. It's very old school and traditional. I don't know how to say this. It reminds me a little bit of, and I've said this before, if you were to take the bottle, you know how sometimes people take wine bottles and they'll use glass cutters and they'll use the empty cut glass bottle and they'll make a candle out of it. If you were to do that with a bottle of Knoll Riesling or Grüner Veltliner, it might very loosely remind you of like the candles that you can get at a corner bodega that have like a drawing of like Jesus on them. It's not the same. It's patron saint and Jesus, but it's kind of this like ornate, maybe a little bit like traditional kind of old fashioned look. And you just don't see that on labels so much anymore. But this is a traditional and kind of like old fashioned winery. One thing that's interesting is as many of these producers are super modern and technological, a lot of them are really heavily steeped in tradition. Some of them don't even have websites. And so if that's the case, Knoll, then it shouldn't be surprising that they just really like their traditional label and they're fine with it. And if you don't, that's also fine too. But in her detailing of talking to the Knoll family, she does give some information for all of these producers, a little bit about the wines that are made in the region and if there's any specific laws or rules or regulations. And one thing that's unique about the Wachau is that there are three different ripeness levels that you can see on a label for, you know, a Riesling or a Grüner Veltliner: Steinfeder, Federspiel, and Smaragd. Now, they refer to, there's requirements about alcohol and ripeness for the wines. The lowest required minimum alcohol and sort of the least amount of ripeness would be the Steinfeder wines. Honestly, this is what I recall from my notes and my visit to Austria. It is not that they don't make a lot of them. It's just that a lot of them are not exported. It's more for domestic consumption. So if you're wondering why you've never seen Steinfeder, Grüner Veltliner, it's because not a lot of it comes to the United States. You've probably seen Federspiel and Smaragd. And each of these terms means something different. And Smaragd is for the highest minimum alcohol level and sort of the ripest quality of grapes. And that term refers to a little lizard. It's a supposedly an emerald-colored lizard that frequents the vineyards and can be found sunning themselves on the, you know, the stone walls and the terraced vineyards. And I learned when I was there, I was at a dinner with, you know, a couple other different producers, and I was seated next to Tony Bodenstein. And he's an amazing winemaker from Prager. And he had a little lapel pin and it was a little lizard. And I was like, wait, that can't be a coincidence. And there is a wine growing association in the Wachau, Vinea Wachau, and their pin is this little Smaragd lizard. And so I was like, that's the coolest lapel pin. I mean, people might think a Master Sommelier lapel pin is cool, but I'm here to tell you, as someone who has, well, actually I have two of them, but as someone who has one of those, the coolest lapel pin is the Vinea Wachau Smaragd Lizard Pin. You can't buy one. You can only get one if you are actually the wine grower. And Emmert Knoll, father and son, both have one. So I just got a real kind of kick out of that. And then when I, of course, saw the nice picture of the family of Emmert Sr., Emmert Jr., and August, there's two brothers, I was like, yeah, I've totally met that guy before. And so it's very fun, just, you know, even in the first 50 pages of this book, to like start having these flashbacks of places I've been and visits I've made, and also great wines, like really, really great wines. So after from Austria, as we kind of skip around the world of wine, the next place that Fiona heads is to Tiempon. So this is where we really understand like what's going on in her family. So she's been married to a man named Jacques Tiempon for like several decades. And his family, it's a big family, and they are Dutch, and there are cousins, and they own a bunch of different producers in Bordeaux. But she and her husband, Jacques, are the proprietors, the owners of three different estates in Bordeaux. Perhaps you have heard of one of these, the most famous being Lepin, if I was not saying that with a French pronunciation, which refers to the pine tree, the lone pine tree on the property. It is a small estate in Pomerol on the right bank of Bordeaux, and it is certainly one of the most expensive wines on the planet. I've never tasted it. I should like to do that one day. They also own a winery called Lif in Saint-Emilion and one called Lert in Castillon. So it's like a satellite region of Bordeaux. And one thing that particularly comes up in this chapter, and in all chapters really, but I noticed it for the first time, is the belief in her family, in the Tiempon family. And she and her husband have some sons, two sons, but they're not old enough yet to be working at the winery. But there's like nephews and nieces and, you know, lots of cousins in this whole family. But one might think if one was born into great privilege, i.e. inheriting lands that they did not have to pay for, and perhaps buildings that they did not have to build themselves or mortgage, you know, that's great privilege, right? And she acknowledges all of that. But one consistent vein that runs through all of these families is that a lot of them are very anti-nepotism. It might seem that, you know, if you were born into that family and you took a more than a passing interest in wine, then you could go work for the family business. And her family and others oftentimes would say, yeah, you can come work for us, but you need to go out and like go to school and develop some other skills and get yourself some education and then maybe come back and work for us, which you have to appreciate, right? Because, you know, you need to be a well-rounded individual, and that's certainly a good way to do it. So this book is not about nepotism and privilege, but certainly some of that does exist in the world. We can't deny that. But her family takes kind of a hard line on that. So in Bordeaux, her family, one of the other, you've probably heard of some of the other producers or the other wineries that the Tiempons actually own. They used to own Troplong-Mondeau. They own Vieux Chateau Sertan, like really great producers. And so, you know, she talks about harvest. And of course, with her family in particular, I mean, I don't know what their financial situation is. I'm sure they're not hurting. But she does emphasize kind of how simple and rustic and kind of how not fancy they are. I don't know. I don't know if they are or aren't, but I appreciate the flex. The family, the Tiempon, there are three cousins who are the winemakers. So her husband is Jacques, and then Nicolas and Alexandre Tiempon. So there's a lot of Tiempon in Bordeaux. And so her family is very clearly, you know, spoken about and talked about. And it doesn't actually, there's not a whole lot of, you know, gossip or, you know, negative stories. It's she's talking about family. So I think maybe she had to mind her whatever she was sharing maybe a little bit more carefully. But when we get into the second season is when I got real excited for this book. So she visits, as I said, my Spanish boyfriend, who has, by the way, been married to his childhood sweetheart for like 30 years. But it's a fantasy boyfriend, right? We're all allowed to have fantasy winery boyfriends and girlfriends. And Alvaro is mine. So you may or may not be familiar with him. He is, well, he's a handsome man. He's got salt and pepper hair and striking blue eyes. But one thing that I remember, because I've met the man, by virtue of working for Jose Andres, I think he came to an event or somehow I got to know him, got to meet him and like fangirl out inside my head, is he's really, really charismatic. And there are stories in here about how he plays the guitar and like rides his horse and his loyal dog is at his side. And he might like play flamenco and sing. And like, he sounds quite dreamy. And it reminded me of just a funny little story. And I learned a lot of new things about Alvaro. I'm going to be on a first name basis with him in this book. So years ago, when I was an itty bitty baby sommelier, very early on in my career, I hate that term, but I was definitely early on in my career. I competed in a wine contest, and I'm a big believer in contests. They haven't been happening in a long time, but if they return and you're a sommelier and you have the opportunity to compete, I always think it's a good idea. It gives you, you know, kind of a comfort level eventually, an exposure, performing in front of a large crowd, talking in front of people, tasting in front of people, doing service in front of people, and that can help if you struggle with issues of nerves. It's just kind of forcing yourself into the fire and you get more comfortable with that. Oftentimes, contests are going to be timed. There's pressure. It's a good way to improve your skill. You have to practice harder than you're going to play, right? And I was competing in, it's like a Somm Slam Star Chefs kind of competition in New York. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I just took the train up to New York for this contest and I made it through the first round, which is cool. I had no expectations of, you know, anything. And so I made it through the first round, made it to the second round. And lo and behold, I made it to the finals. I was not anticipating making it to the finals and I did not pack enough clothes to have a different shirt that I hadn't worn already for 2 days. Cause I think I packed like one suit and like one blouse. Cause I mean, whatever, it's a competition. It's not like I was running a race. And so I was like, 3 days is a little bit of a stretch. And so I was thinking I needed something else. And it was just me and my friend. Both of us are now master sommeliers, but my friend, Alex LaPrat, who has a Scooby-Doo villain name, if ever there was one. LaPrat, I'll get you next time. And so anyway, I needed a clean shirt. And so I stopped off at one of the greatest wine bars in Manhattan, a little place called Terroir. And I had been there earlier in that weekend. And so I knew that I could get a t-shirt there because they sold them. And Terroir, if you've never been, is they preach the gospel on producers they love and wines they love. And they had put out for years kind of a series of different t-shirts with the likenesses of different famous winemakers on them because famous winemakers are like rock stars. And lo and behold, earlier in that weekend, you know, when I'd gone up to New York, obviously I was going to go out and eat and drink a little. I noticed that Terroir was selling a yellow t-shirt with Alvaro Palacios' face on it. And so I was like, sweet, I'm just going to swing by the wine bar, pick up a t-shirt, and then I'll have a fresh shirt for the finals of this competition. And so I didn't think anyone would have noticed, but how naive was that? I was competing in a sommelier contest. So of course, people noticed that I was wearing an Alvaro Palacios t-shirt, but I still have the t-shirt and I love it. And so that was one of my like first funny little stories about Alvaro and how much I love him. But one of the things that's so cool, so his family is based in Rioja and he makes wine in Rioja. He makes a different style of wine in Rioja. And I made a note to search out and see if I can find some of his wines because those wines, the red wines of Rioja, are typically based on Tempranillo-based blends, but he really likes Garnacha. And that ties into, you know, him making wine in Priorat, but he makes a Garnacha-based Rioja. And that's just atypical. And so I made a little note that Jill needs to suss that out. He also makes wine in Bierzo, and he works with his nephew. And so again, family, his father started the winery and Alvaro's got a pedigree. I mean, he went to work in Bordeaux. He worked at Chateau Petrus. He's been around. He's a super, super smart guy. But particularly the current iteration of the family is his brother makes wine, but it's mostly him and his nephew. That's sort of the focus of the family. And so in Bierzo, they're making really great wines based on a local grape called Mencia or Menthia, which I really like. It's a very underappreciated grape. And then probably what he's most famous for and what kind of catapulted him into international winemaking superstardom is his project or his winemaking in Priorat. So Priorat is in northeastern Spain in Catalonia, same area as where Miguel Torres is based, but making a different type of wine entirely. And in the 1980s, one of the kind of people that helped mentor Alvaro, I think they're described as like kind of quirky, hippie, like out there winemakers. And it was this man named René Barbier, who had French ties, but he was in Spain. And this group of winemakers, René, and who I've also gotten the good fortune to meet, and Alvaro, sorry, I just turned the page and I'm looking at his portrait. He's a handsome man. Ah, makes great wine. Sorry, just to pause for a moment. But anyway, they all decided to try their wine at making these wines in Priorat. So Priorat is a pretty extreme terroir for growing grapes and making wine. Super steep hills. It's on the northeastern coast of Spain. There's plenty of sunshine, but the hills are really steep and they plant at altitude. And the wines are typically, they make white wines, but they're probably most famous for their red. And they're usually blends of like Garnacha, Grenache, Carignana, Carignan. And then sometimes international varieties are planted as well. And because it can be very intensely warm and sunny, but then cool at night, Garnacha, which is oftentimes the backbone, it just readily ripens and achieves and accumulates high levels of natural sugar, which can mean high levels of natural alcohol. And so these big, robust wines in Priorat are oftentimes like 15, 16, more than 16 degrees alcohol. They're powerful wines. And at the time that René Barbier and Alvaro were kind of coming up was, if you think about it, like in the 1980s, and who was one of the most influential wine writers and wine critics in the 1980s? Robert Parker. What did Robert Parker like? Big, powerful red wines. And so he awarded very, very high scores to some of these wines. And so that made them really famous and it catapulted them onto the world stage. And so it is kind of a neat story of how that all worked. But one thing that I learned, which was kind of cool, so this group of winemakers, they are kind of based around this small town called Gratayops. Alvaro is the youngest of this group in Gratayops. And I should say, I don't know exactly how old my boyfriend is. I think he's in his 50s. You know, he's definitely older than me, but he's not old. He's, you know, like I said, salt and pepper hair. So he's older, but he was the youngest in this group. And so he got a nickname. He was nicknamed the Dolphin, I guess because he was like young and playful. And so the wine that he made was called Clos Dofi, D-O-F-I. And the Catalan, which is the language of Catalonia, there's different languages in Spain. There's, you know, Castellano Spanish, like the traditional Spanish you would see around like Madrid. And then there's Catalan, which is like, and then there's Basque. There's a bunch of different languages. But the Catalan word for dolphin is Dofi. And all of the wines this like Gratayops group made, they all were called Clos something or other. So Clos is a French word. It means enclosure. It typically refers to an enclosed like by a stone wall vineyard. And all these producers named their wines Clos to emphasize the importance of specific vineyard sites. All these wines were like deep, dark purple. And the wines were, you know, Clos Dofi, Clos de Laubach, Clos Martinet, Clos Mogador, Clos Erasmus. So there's these five Clos of Priorat, just a little wine trivia if you want. And so anyway, that was Alvaro's. And I just didn't know. I had no idea why it was called Clos Dofi. I figured there was probably a good reason, but it was because his nickname as the youngest one in the group was the Dolphin. So again, you guys know how much I love to learn. And he makes other wines as well, L'Ermita and Camin del Priorat, Terrasses del Priorat. He makes all kinds of different wines, but they're really great wines. And I have bought and sold pretty much all of them that I've ever been able to get my paws on. And I'm just super, super fan of Alvaro. So I just really enjoyed this chapter because it reminded me of this, you know, pivotal time in the beginning of my career. And I, you know, crushing real hard on a cutie Spanish winemaker, but then also wines that I have enjoyed for the better part of my career. The visit through Portugal is super interesting, talking about Dirk Niepoor. And one of the neat innovations that he's done is obviously in the Douro Valley. This is home to Port, fortified wine from Portugal, but his kind of pioneering contribution has been to really make a lot of still table wines. And so there's a lot of cool information. I've heard about them more than I have tasted them. Some of them for sure, like the Charm or the Coche, definitely make their way onto like a lot of sommelier Instagram best bottle shots. But it's kind of cool to hear about the man and like all of his quirks and how he got into producing more table wine than he actually, you know, focusing more on that. And once it sort of talks about how he's made table wine and still wines cool again in the Douro. He's going to focus on making port cool again. So you heard it here first. Bring port back to make it even cooler. Though I did see somewhere a white port and tonic in a can. So if you've never had that cocktail, it's a really good, refreshing cocktail. You definitely have it in Portugal. But if that exists domestically in a can, seek it out because port is cool. So in the winter season, there's just two producers, Gaia in Barbaresco in Italy, and then Egon Mueller in the Mosel in Germany. And I have never been to Gaia. I've only been to Italy once and it actually wasn't for a wine trip. So I'm desperately overdue on a trip back. And I will say this one chapter, I was hoping for a little bit more. So the history and the story of the Gaia family is really fascinating. And Angelo Gaia is the, you know, the patriarch of the family now. He's got three children. His wife works with the business. His daughter, Gaia, is sort of the public face of the winery. His daughter, Rossano, works and has projects of her own. And then their youngest child, their son, is also back working for the family. And I think the children are, you know, somewhere between their late 20s and maybe 40. And I think Angelo Gaia is around 80 years old. It was interesting. I think if you've ever met or been to a tasting with Gaia, she is stunning. But one also wonders, as Fiona does in this book, why Angelo Gaia might name his daughter Gaia. Now, for what it's worth, this is a podcast, so you're not reading this. And Gaia's first name is spelled G-A-I-A. And the last name, Gaia, is spelled G-A-J-A. Well, that question, friends, is answered. I appreciate that so much. So at the very end of this chapter, and it's a sweet story, by the way. So Fiona Morrison, at the last page of the chapter on the Gaia family, she asks Angelo Gaia, like, what were you, like, is that like a super egotistical thing to like name your daughter your last name? And it's, even though they're not spelled the same, they're pronounced exactly the same. And he laughs and he says, no, Gaia was our first child. We didn't know if we'd be blessed with another child. And so for my parents and my grandparents, I wanted to carry on the family name, even if we had a girl, because in Italy and many places around the world, when a woman gets married, she might take the name of her husband. And so he wanted to keep the family name going on there. But Gaia is also the G-A-I-A is the name for the like the goddess of the earth. Of course, he and his wife did have two other children, but that's the origin story of Gaia. So look, I love sharing anecdotes. I'm going to share another one. So I barely met Gaia once. And this is, I still laugh about this with some of my friends today. So in addition to competitions, one of the other things that was really beneficial to me in my career was participating in food and wine festivals. And so you might get to travel to, like, I don't know, California for Pebble Beach Food and Wine, or I've been a part of the Naples Winter Wine Festival and auction for years. And the cool thing about these events is it's a festival or maybe it's a charity event. And so oftentimes there's very storied and famous wine producers. And it's a great opportunity to not only taste wines that you might not be able to buy or sell or taste in your own market, but also you get pretty good at, you know, at actually serving these wines, because you might have to pour, like, specific, you know, 2 ounces or 3 ounces for 100 different seats, or you might have to handle and decant really old wine. So it's a great way to pick up skills. Well, anyway, at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, it's a big wine auction for charity, and I've been a part of it for quite a few years. But in the very beginning, I remember it might have been the first year I went, and I definitely felt very out of my depth. There were a group of 10 guest sommeliers. Almost all of them were master sommeliers. I was not. This is much earlier in my career. And so I had a little bit of intimidation or whatever. And after the, you know, the auction and the dinners and whatnot, the culmination of the weekend after the big auction is a brunch, you know, before everybody leaves. And it's a brunch with everybody. The patrons who buy tickets to the auction and bid on all the fantastic lots, the winemakers, the sommeliers, like, everybody gets together and has brunch. So I found myself sitting at a table in the tent. And I didn't know a whole lot of people there. Plus, I was intimidated, so super social. And I was sitting at a table with my friend Mike Marr, who is now a master sommelier, but we definitely were not then. And someone who was a master sommelier and a gentleman and a scholar, a man named Dennis Kelly, who at the time and for a long time was the wine director at the French Laundry. So, legendary place. There's me and Mike. We're a little intimidated. And the three of us are, and I don't know if, I think Mike probably remembers this. I don't know if Dennis Kelly remembers this. I don't really know him. But we were all sitting at this table. We just made our plates for brunch. And who should walk over to our table but Gaia. And she kind of looks, because there's, it's like a 10-top round table and there's plenty of places to sit. And we all kind of, like, our eyes get all big. And she's like, may I sit here? And we were all like, yeah, you can sit here. That's cool. And she, like, gets ready to sit down. And then she kind of, like, looks around, and then she just turns and walks away. We got the hard snub from Gaia. And I don't know why. I don't know if she, like, thought we were someone else, or, like, we looked a little too, like, excited that she was going to join us for some bacon and eggs. I have no idea, but that's literally as close as I've gotten to Gaia. I'm sure she's lovely. We just weren't cool enough to have breakfast together. So this book, it might not resonate that way for everyone who reads this book, but if you've made a career in wine, there's definitely some, you know, some fun stories about different people that you will visit and that you'll meet, you know, throughout your career, because these are some pretty iconic producers. And then the last season of the book is spring. And Fiona visits Louis-Michel Ligier-Belair in Vaune Romanée in Burgundy. And look, those are some amazing wines. If you're not familiar with who he always wears red pants. It's like his signature thing. So it's kind of you can recognize him. He gets touched on a little bit when I talked about Shadows of the Vineyard in a previous book. They're a really wonderful and very reputable producer in Vaune Romanée. And they have some really spectacular, very difficult and very expensive to get Burgundy. But, you know, if you have the means, I highly recommend. But the last chapter is with the Perrin family in the Rhone Valley of France. And I have to say, before I move on to that, I did flag a page in this book. So look, I have a podcast about books, wine books. I love wine books. There is actually, I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but there's actually a Japanese term for a style of decorating, which somehow is a bunch of piles of books everywhere, which I just feel like that's my aesthetic. I see Nadine, my producer, I see her office and it's got bookshelves all over the place. And so I just have, like, a dream file folder of, like, house decorating ideas. And one of them is for the library that I want to build one day. And oh my God, there is a picture of Louis-Michel's office and the library at the Chateau de Vaune Romanée where he and his family live. It is the dreamiest library I could ever imagine. It's like an old tile floor with, like, old rafters, and there's, like, chairs and a library table, and everything is painted this kind of, like, French country blue. It's all antique, but also very chic. And there's a staircase going up to, like, what looks like a little balcony with more books. And each step of the stairs has a pile of books on them. I feel seen. This is what my house is like, but it's like the dreamiest library, a wine library that one could ever, ever want. But I digress. So the last chapter is with the Perrin family in the Southern Rhone, and you are probably familiar with them if, well, for a lot of reasons. They got their hands in some pots, but they are probably most famous for Chateau de Beaucastel, Chateau Neuf du Pape. They also make Côte du Rhône. They collaborated with the Haas family to make Tablas Creek and Paso Robles. And one of their most famous collabs is with the celebrity Hollywood duo formerly known as Brangelina for Chateau Miraval for that rosé. So they're really involved in lots of different things. And what's so cool is the minute I saw that this family was profiled, I was sort of hoping that some stuff that I got to experience when I visited there was going to be detailed. And I was really pleased to see that it was. So I have a little bit of experience, not so much with the family directly, but with the maison. Years ago, I take a lot of dares. It sounds like I'm super reckless and risky, but like, I don't know if the dare is reasonable or even if it's not reasonable, like I'll probably take it. And so this first manifested when I was right out of college and one of my best friends and I on a sort of a dare, but then it manifested. We rode our bicycles across the United States. So we took a summer and we rode our bicycles from Oregon to Virginia. It took about 10 weeks. It was a wild ride. You see a lot of the country that way, right? Well, fast forward a few years later and I was changing jobs. And so it's really hard to just, you know, we're all working people, right? And it's hard to take off a whole lot of time and just, you know, go cycle for a couple of months. But if you strategically plan a job change, it works out very well. And so I was planning just that and I wanted to take some time. And so I basically leaving one job allowed myself the summer before I had to start, you know, saved up a bunch of money, still had a bicycle, and delayed starting at my new job. And my friend Jen and I decided that we would take another bike trip, but this time we would go across France. And so we packed up our bicycles, which is not the easiest thing to do. You can break apart a bicycle. And we had road bikes with hybrid tires. They're like slightly more heavy to be than road tires. And then panniers, bags, kind of saddle bags that go on your wheels. But France is super, super bike friendly. It's much smaller than the United States. The French are really into car camping. So there's like campgrounds everywhere. There's inexpensive hotels. So we didn't have to carry quite as much gear as we did when we were going across the United States. Because you're never not in a town somewhere. France is just not that big. It's like the size of Texas. And so we broke apart our bikes and we packed them up in these what amounted to very large duffel bags. And we, you know, wrapped them up very carefully so nothing would get damaged. And then those big bags would get checked. And that was the scariest part of the whole trip, was watching those bags, like making sure they got loaded on the plane and hoping that nothing would crush them. I mean, they were absolutely covered with, you know, fragile notes on them. And we, you know, we flew into Paris. Getting out of the metro with our giant bike bags, not an easy feat. I don't recommend that, but sometimes you do dumb stuff on a dare. Anyway, we spent some time in Paris. We took the train from Paris to Nantes, and then we rode through the Loire Valley. And then we spent a couple days in Lyon, great city. And then we rode from Lyon south through the Rhone Valley. And then we ended our trip with a little vacation in Nice. This is not a wine trip, but you can't not spend the summer in France and visit wineries. And so I set up a couple of appointments, thanks to producers and importers and distributors that I worked with in Washington, D.C., which is where I lived at the time. And one of the visits that we set up was to go see Chateau Beaucastel, because we were going to be riding through the Rhone Valley. And we realized very quickly that once we rebuilt our bikes together outside of the train station in Nantes, also something I don't recommend doing, we had these giant duffel bags. And it was going to be completely impossible to just carry them with us. And so I contacted, I don't know, the sales director, somebody at Domaine de Beaucastel. And in halting English and hesitant French, we arranged to post, to mail our giant duffel bags to Chateau Beaucastel. And they would hold on to them for 6 weeks. And then that was going to be our last stop, because after visiting them, we were just going to like break our bikes down, take the train to Nice, and then we'd be done. So first, like big props to Chateau Beaucastel, is that they agreed to accept packages from us and then hold on to them for the summer. Step one. Anyway, we ride our bikes through France. And I realize this is not about the book, but this goes to the generosity of this family. And our last stop is, you know, we get ourselves to Avignon, which is, you know, the whole story of Chateau Neuf du Pape. It means new castle of the Pope, and the papacy moved from Rome to Avignon. And so it's really historic and very cool. And we are staying in this like little teeny tiny hotel. And we planned a visit to Chateau Beaucastel. And we visited, we tasted some really great wines, and they asked us while we were there what we were doing for dinner. Now, we had no plans, but you know, you're in a town, Orange, it's not hard to find food. And they asked if they could host us at a restaurant they own. And it's mentioned in this book. So the Perrin family owns a restaurant called Lustelet in Gigondas, which is a neighboring wine village to Chateau Neuf du Pape. And we said, sure, but we looked at our phones and looked at the map, and it was, you know, I don't know how many kilometers, but it was too far to bike in the evening and then try to bike home. And they said, no, we'll arrange a car. And so we said, well, okay. that sounds great. And so we left our bikes in our hotel room and they sent a car for us. And, you know, this taxi drove us to Loustalet. And I should mention, it did not then, but now does have at least one Michelin star, maybe two. It's a lovely restaurant, like gorgeous. And we sat outside and it's like tasting menu only. And I should mention that we were finished with our trip, but we had one last thing to do. When in France, there's a very famous bicycle race. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's called the Tour de France. And my friend Jen and myself were big fans of the tour. And she felt that we would be doing ourselves a tremendous disservice if we rode our bikes through France and did not attempt one of the great climbs of the Tour de France. Well, one of the great climbs is called Mont Ventoux, and it's a mountain in the Southern Rhone Valley, right where we were. And so we planned to climb Mont Ventoux the next day. Now, if you've ever done competitive sports or done like distance racing or anything like that, like usually you want to like maybe drink a lot of water and like load up on some carbs before a really difficult endurance ride or run. Sitting down to a multi-course tasting menu with wine is usually not the recipe for success. But I'm happy to report that we both summited Mont Ventoux the next day. I'm not going to say how long it took us. I will say it's the hardest thing physically I've ever done in my entire life. It's really hard. If you need to bleep me, it's really, really hard. But the crazy part is we had this beautiful dinner. We just realized, you know, like when in France, you know, when are we going to be back in Gigondas? Have to take advantage of this opportunity. They were treating us. We didn't want to be rude. And when we get ready to leave, we thought we were going to have to call a taxi. The car that brought us there had been waiting the entire time. And we had a momentary heart attack thinking, oh God, this is going to be like a 300 euro. Like if that meter's been running. And the Perrin family also had hired the driver for us. So not only did they send us to their restaurant, they treated us to, you know, dinner. And then the driver brought us back to our hotel. So generous and so kind. And it was just the most wonderful thing. And then, it, you know, obviously that hospitality and that good food propelled us up this crazy, crazy ass steep mountain. And so it was just so wonderful. And then we got our bags back and broke down our bikes and packed them all up. And so she talks about just how kind and generous they are. And she mentions the restaurant. And I can tell you from my firsthand experience, like they are that kind and generous. And it's, I think maybe she mentions that a lot of the winemakers in this book, the Perrins included, are really into cycling, into road cycling. And so it might've helped that we were riding our bikes through France. Maybe they thought like sommelier and a sommelier riding through France, like maybe that shone an extra, you know, kind light on us, but awesome family. And it was like the most perfect conclusion to this book. The last part of the book, I think, is actually what really brings it together. She has like a 3-page conclusion, and she really touches on some of the most important topics of this book and why she writes it. You know, that the wine world is now global and it's gone under huge changes, and it's way more rare than it used to be to have family-owned and operated multi-generational estates. And that wine, you know, it's interesting. It's become both democratized and elitist. Wine is incredibly accessible, but also because it's been fetishized and there are cult wines, it's also inaccessible. And there's this huge, you know, gap. Some of these wineries are quite corporate and industrial and huge, but they're still family run. And so she kind of acknowledges all of these kind of dichotomies of the world of wine. And I think it's a really, it kind of just ties it all, just sews it all up together neatly. It's not just a book of 10 different family vignettes. It kind of explains her justification and her admiration for writing about these families and, you know, how they're all very different, but there's a thread that binds them together, and it's their vision and their work and their determination that they need to run their estates well and that they are stewards of the estate, if only for a generation. And I have to love that. There's plenty in the world of wine that is not cool or criminal or, like I said, fetishized or culty, but this book ends on a really great note. So, what works? Well, there is tremendously good information in this book. I was familiar with all of the producers, but I learned something new about all of them. I love, love learning. I like that she includes her favorite wines because some of them make, you know, dozens of different cuvées. And so it's really important to have a couple highlights. And look, sometimes the highlights are going to be the ungettable get, you know, like the Trockenbaron Alsace from Egon Müller, Schwarzhofburg, Riesling, like that wine might be $8,000 a bottle. So it's not for everyone, right? If you could even find it. But she got to taste it and it's one of her favorites and she's going to describe it. So I do appreciate that she has Fiona's favorites. I just also think that's a cute way of describing it. And the pictures are beautiful. She's a really, really good writer. Only once in this entire book, and I think she's British. She speaks English, French, and Dutch, and she speaks French fluently, but she's European for sure. And I think it's a European writing thing where they tend to most accurately use the term variety as opposed to varietal. Only once in this book, and I noted it, was that mistakenly done, and it was probably either editing or just wasn't paying attention to it because everything else is very correct. As for what doesn't work, Every now and then, her take on wine seemed a little bit naive and weird. When she was tasting at Gaia, they were tasting, you know, 20, 30-year-old Barolo and Barbaresco, and she would make statements like, who says Italian wine can't age? This wine proved to me that it can. And I was like, who says that Italian wine can't? Everybody says that Italian wine can age. Like, some of the most age-worthy wines are Barolos from good vintages. So every now and then, there was like an odd statement that I thought was just weird. Not that it doesn't work. I just found it to be, for someone who is so knowledgeable, it was like kind of an odd, naive statement. Other than that, I guess it's just a limited scope. But I think if you understand what this book is going into, that it's just 10 families, 10 families from Europe, and it's 10 different family-owned wine operations, then fantastic. I guess just my, you know, like I said in the beginning, the only other thing that I would have wanted from this book is I would love to hear about some of the family drama. We love family drama. Who doesn't love family drama? But I think she takes the high road. Her family is profiled and she only speaks about these producers in very, well, very classy, very kind ways. And so she doesn't dwell on the negative. She just really focuses on the positive. But you know that there is some hot goss. And I would personally have liked to see a little bit more, but that's just me. It's just not in this book. So for my rating, this is where it's tricky, friends, because this is a great book. But I've thought long and hard about this. And my rating for this book is that it's a borrow. And here's why. It's a great book. It's well-written. It's informative. And you're going to learn something. And the pictures are stunning, particularly the picture of Alvaro Palacios. But the scope is really narrow. It's just a focus on 10 producers. It doesn't go, there's like 10 to 15 pages on each producer. So there are certainly more things to be said on all of these producers. And it's a very, kind of a very rosy take on them. Not that it's not objective. I think it is, but it's definitely with a very kind light. But it's a very specific, I think, intended audience. Besides people who just want to read in bed, I always think about, like, would my friends and family who aren't in the wine industry, would they want to read this book? Maybe, maybe not. But if you are in the wine industry, if you've heard of any of these producers, then yeah, you definitely want to read this book because you will learn something new about the producers. So because of its scope and it's maybe not something that everybody would be down into, I don't know if it has to be on your bookshelf, but it's definitely worth a read regardless. So there you go. 10 Great Wine Families, a tour through Europe. I really dug it and I hope that you will at least read the book, if not buy it. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. Please be sure to subscribe and always feel free to leave us a rating. Tell us what you think. We will see you next week. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.